Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Say at some level I'm still learning or just trying to get used to giving Dhamma reflections. And it's kind of interesting to me the last three times that there's been the potential for giving a Dhamma talk. I was not dreading, but kind of hoping Lumpur wouldn't ask me to give a Dhamma talk. And partly it's because it's like there was just this real feeling inside that there was nothing really to share. It's not like nothing that there wasn't, you know, there's not contemplation happening or there's not knowledge that's there, but it's just something, you know, just wasn't anything sort of bubbling up that felt like I needed to be giving a Dhamma talk, so I was kind of grateful. But it's interesting, like, I think the last time I did give a talk was a month ago before we went on the Yosemite trip, and at that time I took some Dhamma reading material with me. Some Lungdah Mahabua, and I was, you know, really enjoying it. I've not always connected with his style of teaching. He's sometimes very fiery and very, very like warrior-like, and for some reason, I think just his clarity and his the skill as a teacher was really connecting with me, and I was really enjoying that. And then part of the material I've been looking at the last month has been getting ready for a day-long kind of some teaching this weekend that Ajahn Yaniko and I are going to be doing. And so I've been inundating myself with Dhamma, and it's interesting, it just kind of felt like my mind has been more of a sponge, sort of, you know, collecting information. And, you know, it's information that I've been working with in terms of contemplation and seeing connections and working with it in meditation, but it wasn't like my knowledge. It was more like knowledge that I've picked up in books. This is what Lungdah Mahabua said. If I really wanted you to know what Lungdah Mahabua was saying, I would just read that to you. It's not like my knowledge, but the last couple of weeks in particular, I've been re-listening to the Dhamma talks that were, the readings that were given here during the winter retreat 2 or 3 years ago, where we took the fourth Satipatthana and going through basically the suttas and reading what the Buddha and various of his disciples, kind of said on various topics, and was very specifically listening to talks on the five khandhas, the five aggregates. Yeah, this is like probably the second or third time that I've gone back and, say, re-listened to those. And so I found it interesting that as I was listening and hearing Lumpur, Ajahn Kurinadamo's comments, they would trigger a memory of, oh yeah, I remember they also said, this in a, maybe it was in the talk on the Four Noble Truths, and I remember it was either like the first or the last talk, so I was going and listening to other talks in there as well. So it was like, a lot of information was going in. It's thinking about it in terms of the teaching this coming weekend. But then last night, Ajahn Pasana was giving a talk, and he was talking about the five spiritual faculties or five powers, talking about in terms of the five spiritual faculties. And as he was talking, several points that he said kind of, I felt myself kind of like my spine even kind of straighten, like, oh, that's an interesting point. And then I could almost feel like all these synapses sort of connecting in the brain. Like I could almost like feel this like all the knowledge that I had been putting in my head the last couple of weeks or last month, you know, like this, you know, point here and a point there, and then just having some point of reference for contemplation was then all of a sudden, you know, connecting all of those points. And you know, two of the things that Lumpur said in particular that kind of I could actually feel like my whole brain sort of lighting up with activity were pretty you know, kind of simple comments, but one of them was, I can't remember exactly what the phrase was, but it was just sort of like the, you know, mindfulness isn't just deciding to be mindful. It's not like that's you know, just you sit down and practice and say, okay, I'm going to be mindful. So it was that sort of just that comment then started triggering all these memories of other, you know, sort of teachings that I've heard, you know, similar to that, or things that I've been reading. And I think there was another comment too. Was that you know, we can think of you know, thinking that we're not concentrated, or that the mind, you know, isn't getting easily into peacefulness, and so we think that we're like, we don't have that ability to concentrate. So just that concept of, you know, having a preconceived idea of what concentration is, and then, you know, kind of judging ourselves or having a view and opinion about our meditation, you know, based on a presupposed view of what actually concentration or what a peaceful mind is. And that one in particular, you know, started striking a lot of sort of memories and connections. So somehow I might try to, you know, talk about kind of both of these. The other thing that was when Ajahn Pasano was talking about, say, the five spiritual faculties, the, you know, the very first one in that particular list is faith. The Pali word is sada, which is oftentimes we translate it here as confidence or faith. And two of the other sort of teachings that I've been, you know, say, also as part of this whole process of studying, of looking at, was the, say, the seven factors of enlightenment, which is the very first factor there is mindfulness. And then also looking kind of in some of the things that came up in studying looking at the Satipatthana Sutta was the, came up in one of the talks we were talking about called the Iddhipadas. We translated it a couple years ago for the bike pilgrimage as roads to success. And so it's like these are sort of very similar to the Iddhipadas. It's like practices, they're qualities that you need to develop that will bring you success in any endeavor that you pick up. And it's interesting to me, like these three different kind of ways of contemplating, ways of looking at spiritual practice. Oftentimes, though, when the Buddha did lay out a, you know, set of a list of practices, they are sort of usually sequential. Like there's a reason you have, say, like the five powers. It's like, you know, faith is the first one that's there, and so with the Iddhipadas, the first one is interest, is a chanda, and so there has to be like an interest in something, or when you do have an interest, then the mind will get interested and start picking it up. Then with the seven factors, the first one is mindfulness. And it's interesting, like, you know, almost like sort of like combining all three of those sort of practices. It's like, I think at a certain level, it's like you actually really do need to have that, the sada, the faith has to be there. So like if you were, you know, to come to meditate, or picking up a new meditation object, or even like a work project. Like, say, if you're going to be the head cook and you want to do a particular dish you've never done before, or during the work scene, if you're asked to build something, and if you don't have the faith that you're going to be able to do that, or you don't have the confidence in your skills, I always think, like, well, subconsciously like sabotage ourselves, like, you know, like we really don't think we can do it, then we'll probably make sure that we're right. You know, we always want to be right. So if we have this view that we can't do it, then we'll create that. So, you know, we need to, you know, look at it like, you know, approach it as, you know, have some confidence, have the faith that this particular practice, this meditation object, will have results, and you know, and approach it, you know, with a positive attitude. Then, with the say, going to the first quality of the Itipadas, the roads to success. It's you know, the chanda, having an interest in what you're doing. So it's like, you know, picking it up and trying to figure out, like, you know, how something works, or, you know, if you have the confidence, like, you want to start this new particular meditation object, or this meditation, you do a guided meditation, you know, then you start paying attention to what the results are. You the mind. It's like last night when I was listening to Lumpur's talk, when he mentioned just those two kind of phrases, like, I could see my mind got really interested. Like, oh yeah, it's like, yeah, that sparks some interest in me, and I could start, you know, follow that, and you know, contemplation kind of started happening. Then with the say, the seven factors of enlightenment, it's you know, the mindfulness is the first characteristic that comes up. And, you know, that kind of ties into Ajahn Pasana's talk last night of, like, you know, well, mindfulness isn't just the you just sort of saying, I'm good, you know, like, let's be mindful. It's and what immediately came up from my reflection with that was that say, Bhante Gunaratana, in his book the Satipatthana and mindfulness, he, one of his chapters, he kind of goes through, and he definitely has a his the way he teaches is has this very sequential sort of order with, you know, how you develop mindfulness. And so he says, like, when you really are developing the seven factors of enlightenment, that it does start with mindfulness. And you know, say, I think, you know, before, you know, I think in that sense, like, you've already had the confidence that practice is going to work, and you've got some interest, you've sat down, and you're going to start working with it. And then, say, this, you know, mindfulness, when you start practicing it, it's like, you know, one of the first questions is like, well, how do you develop mindfulness? It's like, I always find it fascinating that, I think it was when I was in Anagarika, we had a scientific magazine, maybe Scientific America. It had this story of four different stories in it. I remember one of the stories was this man who was a blind downhill skier. He just set the world record for the fastest downhill time for a blind skier. And then there was another talk on quantum physics, and then there was another talk on I think it was like on mindfulness. And I remember sort of, like, you know, contemplating the all the different talks and how they were all the different articles and how they were connected. And when I started contemplating it in terms of sort of like with mindfulness, it's like, I forget how this all connected, but it was like especially it came clear to me, like, this reflection with quantum physics, because they were talking about, like, say, with the quantum physics, the physicists at the time were talking about consciousness, and they're trying to, you know, try to justify it, or not justify it, but quantify it. And they were talking about it in terms of, like, you know, like, as scientists, at least at this point, they were like, you know, all the scientific methods that they've been using for everything else, it was like, you know, they're trying to quantify it, but it's like, they're trying to weigh it, or they're trying to see what color it is, or they're trying to, you know, see how, you know, long it is or how heavy it is. And of course, you know, none of that applies. And so they were, you know, figuring out other ways of trying to, how do you quantify that? And it was interesting with the blind skier. He had there was something very minor wrong with his eye, and they were able to do some surgery on his eye, and he was able to get 20/20 vision. But yet he'd never had eyesight before in his life, so he was all of a sudden given this whole new sensory input, which his mind had no way of using it. It didn't mean anything to him, visual sensory input. And he said, he described as like when he was trying to, when he first got the vision, he was trying to taste it. He was trying to smell it. He was trying to hear it, the input, because the visual had no reality for him. So then we start then talking about I started contemplating both those kind of articles in terms of like mindfulness, meditation practice. It's like if we've really never ever learned how to be mindful, or we've never had any encouragement in that in our entire life, or even understood what it is or why it's important, then to sort of come to a meditation retreat or come to a monastery and say, okay, now let's be mindful. It's like, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to taste it? Are we trying to smell it? Are we trying to weigh it? So I think it's to me, it's kind of easy to see how it can be difficult to pick up and practice, because it's not something that's necessarily been valued in our lives, or we know much about it. So it's a really good question. How do you develop mindfulness? How do you bring it up? That's the very first one of the enlightenment factors. So I see the Buddha's putting real importance there, that okay, this is something we need to get a handle on at the very beginning if we're going to have that as a desire, as a goal to become enlightened. We need to put that as the emphasis. If you think of mindfulness as, in some lists, it's maybe more in the middle, or in other positions in these lists of importance, but this enlightenment factor, it's from right there in the beginning. And then there's another talk that I remembered of the Itipadas, where in the Anguttara Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi's talking about just how to develop the Itipadas, and there's a interesting line that says it goes through each of the different factors of the Itipada, starting with desire, and then energy, the application of the mind, and then and sort of discernment. This is the way we were talking about them. But it starts off with concentration, fortified by whatever the factor is. So it's like mindful or concentration, fortified with concentration, and then our desire. So be the first one, be concentration fortified by desire. But then the next factor is like this striving effort, putting forth this striving effort. That striving effort is used in all four of those. So it's like this developing of the mindfulness is we have to have that desire, and then the interest, and then really putting the mind to that with the energy. And then what I really really appreciated about Bhante Gunaratana's teaching on the seven factors of enlightenment is that the way he described it in pretty really good detail was the sequence, the order of the factors. It's like when you're working on say one factor, he says that beginning, it's just you're actually just practicing with it, and it's and that's really all it is. It's not an enlightenment factor of say mindfulness. It's like, okay, you're trying to develop it, and then but it's like once you're able to sort of maintain that, he basically says 24 hours a day, continually. It's like at that point you've awakened the factor. It's still not even maybe 100% purified yet, and so it's as an enlightenment factor for it to be awakened. It's this really strong, unremitting mindfulness. So it's we can set a high goal for ourselves, like, okay, yeah, this can be done, and this is the level of mindfulness. And so obviously if you're going to have that kind of mindfulness, it's not just in sitting meditation, but it's in everything that we do, like the moment we wake up, trying to be conscious and aware of what our attitudes are. It's not to say that you should wake up and be like, oh great, it's another day, but it's like, well, we wake up, like, what is the feeling? What is the tone? Just being aware of that, being mindful of that, and everything that we do throughout the day, every interaction we have, just really bringing attention to that, and developing this continual mindfulness. Then the way Bhante Gunaratna describes this is like it's the next factor in this list of seven is what you need to purify the previous factor. So it's like with the seven factors of enlightenment, the next factor is called Dhamma Vichaya. So it's investigation. So when you develop mindfulness, you're putting forth the effort and the energy, and then you start investigating. You start investigating like what was successful, what actually helped you to stay mindful. Were there certain techniques or practices that were helpful, and what didn't work? So you start using that the quality of investigation, and then from there that quality of investigation, when you really start working with that again, you've just awakened that factor. You haven't perfected it. But it's something that you start working with more and more and more, and that's the mindfulness. Gets stronger because you start becoming mindful of the investigation. You start becoming mindful of trying to figure out how the mind is working. Finding the more and more skillful means to be mindful. So you start investigating that, and then once that becomes awakened, that factor becomes awakened, that awakens is the next factor, which is energy. So it's like, so if the mind is like, I could see that last night when Ajahn Pasama said that, like, I could almost feel like my head starting to tingle. It was just like, okay, wow, okay, there's the investigation has been awakened. Not that it was an enlightenment factor, but at least that part of the mind kicked in. And then with that energy, tingling, you could definitely get a sense of like when the mind is interested in something and you want to know the answer to something, that brings energy. And then that factor, when you start paying attention to that, like, okay, yeah, this is I'm more interested in this, I'm more awake. This is that energy. For most cases, especially when it's balanced, but is energizing and feels good, and so then we want to do that more. If you pay attention and are we're already working with mindfulness and investigation, and so you start seeing that increased energy. That feels good, and that's the fourth factor of piti. Sometimes translated as rapture, but it can just be this energetic, even sort of like pulsating feeling in the body. It can actually be very pleasant. It can also be sometimes gets really extremely strong, almost too strong, and so But if you've awakened that factor and you start working with it and try to purify it and to, you know, make it more more balanced, because it can get too energetic, and it can sometimes be almost frightening. And so in that, you know, investigation into that and paying attention to the energy, then the way you perfect it is that energy then becomes paucity, is the Pali word, which is then tranquility. So it's like, you know, you've got the investigation going, the energy's good, and then you get this really subtle, it can become really subtle, positive energy, and then that can lead to the tranquility. Then when the mind, you know, does get tranquil, and then it can lead into concentration. That's when the mind has all the other factors behind it, and then does lead into concentration. And then when the mind does get concentrated, and then it's the last factor is equanimity. And then this kind of just showing that the Ajahn Pasana is that comment about mindfulness, really triggered that whole train of thought of there is something to focus on, to develop, and there is a one way of talking about it is this very progressive way of cultivating that mindfulness, and then seeing the direction that it can take us. The other comment that Salimpur made that I wanted to contemplate a little bit was that sense of having a preconceived idea or a fixed sort of notion of what, say, concentration is, or what that can feel like. Or it was more like, I think when Lumpur is talking about it, is like, some people do have the ability to to sit down and to their mind to go into this really quiet peaceful state, where other people, they can sit down and their minds are still mulling over concepts and thoughts, and their minds don't easily settle down. And then especially for people like that, they can kind of judge themselves and think that something's wrong, or that they something's wrong. And so, with that, initially, the first thing it came up with is I remember one of my very first meditation teachers kind of was talking about this, and was saying that one way that you can kind of test this is that if you're sitting in meditation and you've tasted a little bit of concentration, or you've had a quiet mind at times, but you're sitting there and the mind just won't settle down, and so maybe you've even given it some sort of task to do a particular type of meditation that uses the mind, but then it just doesn't settle down. To just do something very simple, like doing an exercise of counting, counting. I think you said like to count from 1 to 5. Then count 1 to 6, and up to 1 to 10, and then back from 10 down to 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. And if you can do that, and your mind never wavers from that that exercise, it actually shows that your mind is very concentrated. Like if you're able to hold on to a task and never get distracted from that. That you actually are, the mind is pretty strong in that sense. And so in that situation, your mind actually might be wanting to do more activities. Like, we have this preconceived idea of maybe meditation is just entering into this nothingness. The mind actually is in a situation like that would be, it might be more advantageous to pick up something like, say, the 32 body parts, and either just like initially you know, like if you haven't memorized the list, you know, go through, and even as a meditation, just to go through, have the list in front of you, and with the book open, and just to memorize it. Or if you have it memorized and you have a good sense of what the different organs look like, or if you've had that practice, then to you just use it at that period as a visualization. And so I think it's really for people that know that maybe that you know their mind doesn't easily settle down, I think it's good to develop, you know, several different types of meditations that actually really require you to use the mind in a really skillful way, and to, you know, just let go of the idea that meditation should be leading you into this sort of, you know, really peaceful sort of voidness. And and then what you'll find is that if you do pick up an object, like, you know, some type of visualization meditation or some sort of where you're using the mind in a very directed way, you might actually arrive at that point where the mind does get quiet. It gets really interested in what you're doing and becomes one-pointed and focused, and because of that it goes into equanimity. And then, because of the equanimity, it doesn't need to be contemplating anything. So, like, you go through the seven factors of enlightenment just by, you know, picking up an object that the mind, you know, visual or a very contemplative kind of meditation, you know, can lead you, you know, through those seven steps, and then, you know, leave you in that state of sort of equanimity. Two of the meditations that, in particular, that I found, you know, quite helpful was in doing that exact same thing and I'm not going to get into the first one here at all, but the loving kindness meditation, you know, using that as a you know, going through the phrases, but it's more than just a visualization. It's also, you know, very visceral, being in the body, you know, having the experience of, you know, say, you know, using the phrases, but you're really trying to pay attention to, like, you know, when you're using the phrase, you know, may I be safe, or may I be happy, may I live with ease, you know, really getting a sense, you know, like what that feels like in the body, or when you're doing other beings, you know, having the memories of people, like if you're doing a loved one or something like that, you're wishing them to be happy. You know, really bringing up real memories, real experiences of them when they were happy. So it's like you're, you know, making these experiences, you know, come to life, and so, you know, of course, when that happens, then the mind does get interested, and the meditation can take off from that. Another meditation that I only use this a couple times a year, but when I do use it so far, every time it's had I think, you know, fairly, my mind does get intrigued with it, and it is useful. I'm afraid if I ever, like, you know, tried to do this as much as I do, like, say, the loving kindness meditation, that it would get old and you kind of lose its interest in the mind. If you get too familiar with something, you'll lose the interest in it, possibly. But it's the sutta on the lesser or shorter discourse on voidness. And it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 121. And this has been on my mind just because the retreat that Ajahn Nyaniko and I are going to do we picked the subject of a topic for the subject of neutral feeling, and somehow I had this idea of, you know, possibly the first day we have to give a Dhamma talk on Friday night, and was thinking of doing this as a guided meditation and connecting it in a way to that. I really like this particular meditation because it's a very visual meditation. I was thinking about, you know, kind of talking about it in a little bit more detail, but I don't think I will. I will say this about it is that, the very first time I ever, I probably had read the sutta before, but I was living with Ajahn Punadamo, and he used it as one of his Dhamma talks, and did it. He actually started the, it was like a Saturday night, and did it as a guided meditation, and then gave a Dhamma talk about it afterwards. But I find it's a really interesting meditation, and he has on his website. You just go to Arrow River Forest Hermitage, and I think he's got a couple of links or the menu on it. He has something like further talks, and then this one's called the Formless Attainments or something like that. It gives two pages of kind of instructions on how to do it, and it's an interesting meditation in the fact that it is all about it's using your imagination, and it's different from say most types of meditation in that it's a meditation where he phrased it as a practice of negation. So you start off with like really just paying attention to what your experience is right here, right now, and then you really just tune into sort of the peacefulness, sort of the voidness of this experience that we're in right now. You just get a sense that it's like just being in the monastery, just being in this room. It's a lot. There's a lot of voidness here. There's a lot. This being in this room right now is a lot less complicated than, even just having to drive here. Just the all the choices and decisions we have to make. And so it's really bringing into clarity into the present moment. What is our reality, and actually just tuning into there's a lot of voidness in our experience in being here. Then part of this meditation is it's not just your imagination, but you're actually trying to tune into reality as much as you can too. So it's like here, like we're not only just in this room, but it's a we're in a forest. We're, on the planet, and so the further you go into this meditation, it's like each step, sort of like he'd recommend like you'd be 5-10 minutes in the meditation of just being aware of being here in this room, and then to end that meditation, you kind of go back and you reflect on, how much more peaceful this is than what you were before you came here. So like that'd be like almost kind of like contemplation of the village is what it's called. So you just see the complications of that, and then this is more simple than that. Then what you do is from this situation here, you start noticing that even though there is voidness here, there are disturbances here. And so the first one the Buddha has you points out is that just other people, hearing people making noise or coughing or being around other people. So the meditation is very consciously removing your perception of other people. And so you focus on everything other than people. And then so you start noticing, there's the room, or you start noticing if you kind of expand your consciousness a little bit, it's like we are in the countryside, we are still in the mountains, Northern California. So you start paying attention to the kind of voidness of that, of just the voidness of nature, of the peacefulness. And I usually, with my meditation, when I do this, I try to like just even in imagine myself on a in a place, even outside of this room, but like being out in the forest, in as much detail as I can imagine. I try to imagine like the perfect ideal outdoor place to be meditating. And so you bring that into your awareness. Even though you're sitting here with, say, 20, 30 other people, you know, in your mind, you've totally, say, negated that. So and then again, sort of sitting 5-10 minutes with that, and just, you know, noticing, the much more peacefulness of that. Then in the sutta itself, even the Buddha has you then, you know, you start noticing there are disturbances, even sitting in the outdoors and in the forest. But then you go back and you reflect, well, yeah, but this is more peaceful than when I was sitting with 30 other people, or the distractions that were in the monastery. And then, so then you go back again to this meditation of being in the forest, and then you negate the vegetation. And so you contemplate, it's called contemplation of the earth. And so you try to see the, you know, like where you're sitting as, you know, just the earth element, the solidity. And you start seeing, you know, letting go of any disturbances that there were with regards to, you know, the vegetation part of the world. And the commentaries make the comment that, you know, that when you get into contemplation of the earth, this is one of the kasina meditations. And so this is one of the, when you if you've developed that particular meditation, you can actually sort of get into, say, deeper states of concentration, jhana states, based on meditation of the earth. Then again, with this one too, you start noticing that there are disturbances in your mind about the meditation on earth. And then Ajahn Jeff, when I was reading or listening to some talks of his on this particular meditation, you know, he always points out that you go back to the previous one. So when you're doing the meditation of earth, you go back and meditate on just briefly the meditation of the forest again. And the reason for this is that you see in more detail, like after you've had the peace of, say, the concentration maybe that came up from meditation, of, you know, all the negation of everything else, of the, and you're just with the earth, when you go back to the meditation on the forest, you'll see those disturbances a little clearer, and you'll see, you know, you have that more interest to let go of them, to go deeper into your meditation. So then from the, you go back again to the meditation on earth, then you notice the, it's called boundless space. So your meditation goes in and you negate the entire planet, and you just notice the space. You know, I think Lumpur was talking about that last night too. It's like, you know, we notice, you know, like when we come in here, we notice the walls, we notice the floor, we notice the Buddha image. But the, you know, in that meditation, when we were, you know, meditating, the very first one, just the meditation of the being in this room, you know, that space was, boundless space was there even in that meditation. But we were paying attention to the noise, the people, the Dhamma talk, or all these other experiences that are real and valid, but we were giving those more importance. And so then, so we, through this whole process of negation, then we're just paying attention to this boundless space. Okay, each one of these different levels, and you stay at for 5-10 minutes, and then what you start to notice is even when you're just aware of boundless space, there's disturbance there, and the disturbance there is your mind. You know, there's something that's aware of that space, and so you then the next process would be to go back and then start paying attention to the consciousness that's being aware of that space. It's even, you know, more refined. There's more voidness just in being aware of that. And then from there you go on to nothingness. So it's like before when you are meditating, you're paying attention to, you know, how consciousness arises, how it's there, what's it feel like in your body, just to be aware, to be conscious. And then if you're able to, then you can let go of that and just be aware of, you know, the nothingness. What's that like? Ajahn Puddhadhamma makes a real strong point that you can't try to intellectualize this. It has to be kind of a natural. If you do try to intellectualize it, that does get in the way of it. So it's just part of planting that idea. Like, okay, you can think, most of us can be aware of what it is to think and tend to be aware, but you just trying to imagine, like, what would that be like? Just even let go of that. You know, maybe something will arise for you. And so, you know, then you just sit in that experience for a while. And then the next one beyond that is this one you definitely can't try to intellectualize, because it would ruin it, but it's called neither perception nor non-perception. And that's sort of explained as the, let's say it's called neither perception, because it's because they're at that level. If you really were able to get into that, there's no object or subject. So like there's no one really perceiving, and there's nothing that you're perceiving. So it's not perception, but it's not perception, because that would be annihilation. And so so it's a very 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 subtle difference between these. And then this particular sutta is talking about this in terms of, of course, these are really deep states of the jhana, and the called the arupa jhanas, the non. That the voidness that the Buddha is talking about is nibbana in this particular case. And then he makes the point that, say, that particular voidness, when he says actually all along, like even the voidness of when you just come into the meditation hall and you're sitting here and there's just a little bit more voidness. He says, this is true and valid and real voidness. And then the deeper you go into it, it's like even up to that state of neither perception nor non-perception, that still is a genuine, pure voidness as well. And then I think from an arhant's perspective, the sutta ends with him saying that even in this state of neither perception or non-perception, there still is the perception of the six sense bases. So it's like there is the sense of the body being there. But I just kind of brought this meditation up though, just because if the mind is, like as Lumpur was saying, the mind doesn't enter into very easily into the state of just dropping things. I think that's that particular sutta is a really skillful way. If your mind does like being active, if you follow that and one thing is like on meditations like this, if just having it written out, so you can go to Ajahn Puddhadhamma's website and he gives a little bit of instructions, and you can just write those instructions out, or print them out, and have them in front of you, and just go through it and get yourself familiar with it. Any particular meditation, say like doing the body parts or loving kindness, using the phrases, just have them written on a card in front of you, so you don't have to kind of hold those, but you have these guides to help you. I think I'll leave that for our contemplation for the evening. Pandamaya Namakataya Sadhuka.